At the start of last year, before his first workshop submission was due, we didn't see Jordan for a week. At the time, we didn't know this kind of hibernation was typical. Now, we've come to expect it. We bug him about it. We roll our eyes a little. But then he turns in his story, and it's like, oh right, that's what he was doing. Worth it. Jordan is a writer, no doubt about it. What else is Jordan? Diehard Jimmy John's patron. Compulsive pacer. Diet Mountain Dew lover. Ardent reader. The boy has literally read every word that Lori Moore has ever written. I once asked Jordan if I could borrow one of her collections. No, he said, very politely. Sorry, but no. As it turns out, Jordan is never without Lori Moore. These books go everywhere that he goes. He did, however, offer to send me write-ups of any stories I wanted to read, because they are saved on his computer. A little weird? I thought so too. But actually, no. See, Jordan complains that he is a slow reader. But this is only because when he reads, he's not just reading. He's studying the way that other people write, cataloging, calculating, and immersing himself in their words. And I think any author would kill to be respected by someone this thoughtful. Those of us in his classes are lucky to benefit from the same kind of reverence. His comments on our stories show how he has invested himself in our work. It's an entirely selfless way, and his suggestions line up almost disturbingly with those of our professors. Jordan knows what he is talking about. When it comes to his own work, he always believes in improvements. Once so hard that he made the seemingly docile Rick Bass storm out of workshop when he asked for a class vote on which of his stories was objectively superior. He revises his stories as I've never seen anyone revise. He overhauls them completely to make them better, sometimes discarding everything but one image from a draft to use for the next. It pays off. Jordan's work has appeared or is forthcoming in the Albion Review, the Appalachia Review, 14 Hills, and others. What is maybe Jordan's best quality? That he is completely unaware of how good he is. Once, he attached his workshop story to an email that read, "What is the worst part about this story, I wonder?" This level of self-consciousness and lack of arrogance permeates his work. Jordan was one of the first people I met when I moved here. At Doc's Sandwich Shop, we discussed what we like to write about. Jordan said that he mostly wrote about lonely people, and gay people, and occasionally, to change it up, gay lonely people. This is not exactly untrue, but in spot-on Jordan form, it is far too self-deprecating. In Jordan's stories, women attend their own funerals, gay group therapy sessions turn ugly, alcoholics develop paternal attachment to their houseplants, interspecies friendships flourish on YouTube, grown women dress up as babies for Halloween, and psychics tell us that we have nothing to feel but feel itself. In this world of his making, very little actually happens, and yet somehow we are hooked. His work is all about character, and isn't that all we really care about anyways? He creates people who intrigue us for the entire length of a story and then some. We follow their neurotically elaborate trains of thought from start to finish and pause at their one-liners that cut down to a bare-boned human desire. His characters strike a very delicate balance, at once funny and hurt, endearing and damaged. And these unnervingly familiar qualities make them eternally relatable and disarmingly genuine. We are mesmerized because they are us and we are them. I'm very proud to be introducing him tonight. Please welcome Jordan Rawson.
Definitely means a lot. Thanks to my mom, who's here, 28 years ago, she birthed me. And then 2 days ago, she flew out here from Maryland to be at the reading. And between 28 years ago and 2 days ago, she did a whole bunch of other great stuff, too. Once a kid was mean to me, and she prank called his family for years afterward. Almost got a misdemeanor, but did not. Okay, so thank you also to my fiction professors, Kevin Canty, Dee McNamer, Deborah Erling, Bill Kittredge, David Gates, and the occasionally docile Rick Bass. I feel so lucky to be learning from you all, and I just can't believe my good fortune, so thank you. Thanks to Judy Blunt and Karen Scholm. Thanks to the Top Hat for giving us the great venue. And thanks, of course, to Beth and BJ for organizing Second Wind. Finally, thanks to Ed Skook, who I'm excited to be reading with. So I'll be reading a story about a gay, lonely person to change it up. The story is called Eastern Market. When I was a little boy, I thought human resources could either mean resources that were used by humans or resources that were made from humans, from human ingredients. I imagined a person warehouse where non-humans shopped for all their human needs. And now, as half of the human resources department at the Detroit Zoo, I know that it's a little of both, but mainly it's a person warehouse. Today, however, is Saturday. And even though I'm working, I am not making sure employees fill out their W-4s or enrolling them in their benefits plans or taking out any owed child support from their checks or administering drug tests and sending out rejection letters to the 40% who fail. Instead, I'm downtown in Eastern Market, petitioning to get a proposal on the ballot that would reinstate the zoo tax, which would otherwise expire in January. If we don't get enough signatures or not enough people vote for it, then the zoo will go broke sometime in March and close. "Who would you rather have?" says Annette, the other half of the Human Resources Department. "Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire?" At the office, we play one continuous game of Would You Rather. It allows us to get through those days in which we never leave our desks, when there's a steady stream of employees with reimbursement requests and questions about their pay. "Who would I rather have?" asks Derek. "Who would I rather have do what?" I've dragged Derek along to help, although so far, he's only sat at our table doing a sketch on the Etch-a-Sketch that Annette brought for her daughter, who is instead doing one of the word search puzzles from her book. Her name is Gwen, and she's mentally handicapped. "Just in general," I say. "How am I supposed to know?" says Derek. Derek is lonely, older than I, in need of a biological kid or two. He recently determined that he's bisexual, that he's always been, that we are no longer suitable living companions. "Fine," I say. "Then who would you rather have do your taxes?" Annette and I laugh, but Derek frowns. He assumes we're making fun of him, which we are, in a way. Plus, he dislikes inside jokes. He teaches a class for adults with violent histories, teaches them restraint and basic arithmetic, and he's learned the importance of including everyone. Get two of them laughing about something he's said before, and the whole class goes berserk. They think the joke's about them. It is early, but it's already hot, even for August, and there aren't many people here yet, which I'm thankful for. Annette and I each take a clipboard and begin meandering around, although not too far from our table. We're between a Latino couple's flower stand and a table with Middle Eastern food, and as far as I can tell, we're the only ones not actually selling anything, the only table with nothing people would ever want to buy, save the zoo yard signs, a few rolls of lapel stickers and bumper stickers, and a couple hundred pamphlets. "Done," Derek says suddenly. And I watch as he shows whatever he's etched on the Etch-a-Sketch to Gwen, who giggles. "You're funny," she says, what she always says. And I feel a rush of something, sadness, jealousy, rise up from my stomach and into my face, where it lingers, before sinking back down again, slowly, like the water in a clogged toilet. "Sign a petition to save the Detroit Zoo," I say, part yell, part murmur. I lock eyes with a woman dressed in flannel, dragging a wagon with some potted plants. What's wrong with the zoo? She says. Funding ends in January. I'm all talking points. No mention of the word tax, or even public. The signatures allow people to vote in November to bring it back. The woman nods, takes the clipboard, and signs. I feel oddly powerful, accomplished, popular. Good luck, she says, and continues through the market, the wagon rattling behind. I look over to Annette, who gives me a thumbs up, and then to Derek, but he doesn't see me. His head is down. He is, apparently, already engrossed in a new sketch. I worry about Derek, something I resent. He is bald and short and prone to ear infections. When he loses his temper, it comes off as self-consciousness about his smallness, and my heart melts a little. He yells, swears, his face reddens, and I want only to comfort him, to pat him on his back, to give him money for the arcade, to fold him up and put him in my pocket. When he ended things and I began sleeping in the guest room, I grew increasingly drawn to his body. I became interested by anything it produced, and I started doing things, strange things I never did while we were together, eyeing up close his nail pairings and rolling them between my fingers, checking for pubic hair on his bar of soap, even once sniffing the insoles of his sandals, the buttery popcorn damp of them, and it was then that I realized I had to leave. Excuse me, I shout to no one in particular, holding the clipboard high above my head. I tell myself that I'm glad to be here. Would anyone like to sign a petition to save the zoo? Easter Market is getting more crowded, and often this is all I need to say. Mostly, the people are nice and receptive, suspicious perhaps at first, but then eager to help. Thanks for doing this, some of them say. Keep it up. Annette is taking a more active approach, going directly up to people and practically shoving the clipboard in their faces. After they sign, she hands them a Save the Zoo lapel sticker, although if it's a man and he's alone, she slaps it on his chest herself and smiles. Tell your friends, she says. Maybe I'll move into the zoo, I say to Annette when there's a brief lull. Problem solved. I could, I know, get away with it. The band teacher at my high school lived in the school for 2 years before the principal caught him in the bathroom, shirtless and washing his hair in the sink. Word got around. He'd been sleeping in the green room, hanging up his clothes amid the three-piece suits from Hello Dolly. You can play cards at night with Jenny, says Annette. Jenny is our hippo. Employees fought over who got to name the animals, and so the CEO gave the job to Annette, who isn't an animal person, and who chooses, without fail, names that are common and waspy. William, Elisa, Christopher. Names that aren't at all fitting for wild, dangerous creatures. Parents with kids keep asking what it's like to be employed at the zoo. They find it exotic, and see it as an opportunity to show their kids that work can be fun. I love it, I say, not wanting to disappoint. Somehow the kids seem to know I'm lying. They ask if I bond with the animals. Absolutely, I say. But the truth is, I haven't bonded with the animals. Our office isn't even inside the park. It's in the administrative building right off the highway, and we're nowhere near the animals. We're near the maintenance building. Annette goes off to talk to the Latino couple who signs the petition, and then to the two men at the Middle Eastern table. Your mom's quite the saleswoman, I hear Derek say to Gwen. We've dressed them up in matching novelty elephant caps from the Detroit Zoo gift store, gray and velvet with enormous elephant ears and a trunk protruding in the front. Occasionally, Derek will nuzzle Gwen with it, like a dog wanting to be petted. He's been playing with her as if she's a little girl. But Gwen is older, a teenager, and she thinks he's flirting, I feel sure of it. She's taken a shine to Derek at any rate, even though, according to Annette, she's often skittish around strangers. I tell myself that I'm glad to be here. I am. Annette comes back from the two men. They didn't sign the petition, she scowls. They seemed gay, so maybe you should talk to them. I look at the men, judging. They do not seem gay. Sprawled and relaxed in their chairs. Although now that Derek is bisexual, who knows? Derek is looking too. You're just saying that because they're two men, he says. Maybe, shrugs Annette, and then she asks Gwen if she's doing okay, if she's having fun, if she's hungry. Look, Mom, says Gwen, Derek drew a giraffe. Wow, says Annette, giving the Etch-a-Sketch a quick, uninterested glance. Annette is a good friend and goes out of her way to give Derek a hard time. Derek takes back the Etch-a-Sketch and shakes it clear. He's annoyed and I feel a little bad. Maybe draw an elephant, I say. I begin to rub his shoulders, but he tenses up. He stares down at the gray screen, not moving a muscle. Eastern Market is now packed with people. Sign the petition to save the zoo, I bellow and feel like a carnival barker. I'm getting into it. Step right up and save the zoo. Sure, I'll sign, says a homeless woman emerging from the crowd. She has pink hair and pigtails and is pushing a shopping cart filled to the brim with stuff. Clothes, blankets, some pots and pans. I always sign petitions, and she takes my clipboard and scribbles her name. She sees the table behind me and approaches it. How much for the stickers? Everything's free, says Derek, proud that he's helping. Wonderful, says the woman, and she takes all of our bumper stickers, all but one of the rolls of lapel stickers, all but two of the pamphlets, and all of the yard signs, and manages somehow to shove them all into her cart. I say, and I begin to stop her, but then don't. Keep it up, she smiles, and wanders off, past the Latino couple's flower stand, to some other tables farther down. Sometimes I imagine living at the zoo and getting caught by the CEO. He'll fire me and I'll have to gather up my belongings. I will have an armful of clothes, a razor and shaving cream, a sleeping bag. I will have a shopping cart and I will put these things in it. Other times I imagine living at the zoo but on display for the public as one of the attractions, shitting and fat and sunning myself in my pool like Jenny the Hippo. In the winter, when it gets cold, I will go inside my building where the floors will be heated. Annette is sulking, still upset about the men who refused to sign the petition. Now I feel awkward just standing here, she says. It's made me depressed. A case of the Saturdays, I say, and we laugh because of the idiocy of it all. Derek looks up at us suspiciously. What's going on over there? He says, in an old-time policeman voice. You're funny, says Gwen. How much for that elephant cap? Asks a woman with a baby in her arms. $20, I say. It's a deal. The woman uses her free hand to fish a 20 from her purse and gives it to Derek, who gives her his hat. I've got a 6-year-old at home who will love this. And would you mind signing a petition to save the Detroit Zoo? No. She says, I'm already on too many lists. It doesn't even ask for your email or phone number or anything. She shakes her head, apologetically, then walks to the flower stand and inspects some of the tulips. Derek, says Annette, Walter and I are doing all the work. We brought you here to help, not to hang out with my daughter. He doesn't respond. He sits for a moment as if thinking and then asks Gwen for her elephant cap, which she happily gives him. He puts it on and stands up on his chair. Attention, everyone, he yells. Attention, everyone, please. Some people look at him briefly and then keep walking, but others stop and stare. I am an elephant, and my home is endangered. My home is the Detroit Zoo, and we need your signatures or it will close. He is speaking in what is apparently his elephant voice, which is part squawk, part wise man. A small crowd has gathered around the table. The Latina woman at the flower stand is taking a picture with her cell phone. Gwen is gazing up at him, starry-eyed. Even Annette seems awestruck. Sign the petition, Derek is shouting, or I'll be forced to sell myself to the Republican Party. People cheer, applaud, form two lines behind me and Annette. Derek sits down, pleased with himself, and gives Gwen a high five. By mid-afternoon, we've lost some steam. We're all at the table now, eating Middle Eastern food and letting people come to us. The sky's clouded a bit, and there's a heavy breeze. We are playing Would You Rather. It's my turn. Who would you rather have hold you tight and tell you everything is okay? Mickey Rooney or B. Arthur? B. Arthur, says Annette. Gwen chortles, shrieks in guilty pleasure. But she's a lady. So, says Annette, I'm not allowed to want her to hold me tight? All right, I say, but here's the catch. They're both topless. Annette considers this. Still be Arthur. Who would you rather have, asks Derek, who's gotten the hang of it. Elliot Gould or Alan Alda? Elliot Gould, I say. Wait, really? Says Annette. Oh, come on, I say. We all know Alan Alda's too much of a pussy to do anything. Eventually, I will leave Detroit and move to a nearby city, one with a name like Fowlerville or Milford. I'll write lots of letters to friends and sign them always Muddled and Milford, Walt, like a post in an advice column. The weather is definitely turning. It's getting cloudier, more windy. The sun is hazy and dull and far away looking. There are fewer people here now, and they're tired and sunburned and uninterested in saving the zoo, which is exactly how I feel. I've been working on my own Etch-a-Sketch. I've etched a bed, and beside it, two stick figures, one with boxy eyeglasses and one with long hair. I show it to Derek. It's your wife comforting you after your lackluster performance on your wedding night. Ha! Says Annette. You're funny, says Gwen. It occurs to me, suddenly, that it's not my sex that Derek isn't interested in. He is, after all, bisexual. He is, simply, not interested in me. The men at the Middle Eastern table are getting ready to leave, packing up their remaining meat pies and kebabs. The Latino couple has already left. We missed the memo, says Derek. Tell me about it, says Annette. I feel a drop. I hold out the palm of my hand. Is it raining? I think so, says Derek, and without saying as much, we stand up and get ready to leave. We invite Annette and Gwen over, and by the time we pull into the driveway, it is pouring. When Gwen gets out of the car, she runs to the end of the driveway and picks something up. Look, she says. She returns cupping a tiny animal, a baby of something, furless and weak and with a tail. Ta-da! We should put that back, I say. But the rain will kill it! Let's bring it inside until the rain stops, says Derek. We'll put it in a shoebox. Whatever we need to do to get out of this rain, says Annette. We disagree on what it is. Annette and I say it's an infant mouse with a birth defect. Derek says it's a newborn squirrel or possibly a chipmunk. Gwen has decided simply that it's male. She's named him Leroy, and somehow the name is perfect. I go into the bathroom, run my face under cold water. It's red and sore. My arms and legs ache. Back out in the living room, Derek and Annette are drinking beers. The room stinks like wet shoes and feet. You make my life smell bad, I tell Derek. It's not me, he says. It's Annette. She farted, says Gwen. I drop my jaw in mock dismay. Annette! I turn to her, hands on hips. Did you fart? Did you make it smell bad? I am speaking slowly, loudly. Annette, Gwen, and Derek are all laughing, giddy with fatigue. Did you fart? I say again. It was you, blurts Gwen, pointing at me. Walt farted, exclaims Annette. Ooh, says Derek, like a third grader. You're in trouble. I begin to feel something, resentment or fear, come over me. The zoo is going to close, I'm sure of it, but I'll refuse to leave. I'll get arrested, and later, at my hearing, the judge will force me to attend a class where I can learn restraint and basic arithmetic. I grab a beer and sit down next to Derek. I grasp for his hand, but, not finding it, see it resting on Gwen's head. She's sitting cross-legged in front of the couch, the shoebox in her lap. The two of them are peering down at Leroy. He doesn't like his shoebox, says Gwen. She stands up, pondering. Leroy, I can see now, is stiff on his side. She moves away from the couch. God damn it, I say. We should have just left it outside. Gwen gives me a frightened look. Mom, she says. Her voice has shifted, become shrill, tense with panic. Leroy needs a doctor now. An alarm is being sounded, and Annette enters parenting mode. She goes to her and begins to whisper things, comforting parenting things. And suddenly, Derek is there too, on the other side of Gwen. I'm in trouble, she says. I look at the three of them, and then I look just at Derek, who's rubbing Gwen's back. I'm in trouble, she says again. She begins to cry. No, you're not, Derek coos. You're not. I'm in trouble, she wails. You're not, says Derek. I'm in trouble. She is shrieking now in a terrified, awful way. I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. It is the voice of someone, a little girl, who feels dangerous, who feels like a destroyer. Thanks.